to SER.
Guys.
107.3.
All right. All veils and...
All veils and misty, streets are blue. Almond looks that chill divine.
So how was it last night with the Australian premiere? Great to see the room packed, but I'm gathering it was a little more emotional than Tribeca, maybe?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's Michael's hometown, and yeah. So you not only got, I think we had 180 of our own guests, but you not only got those, but you then got, you know, hundreds of more people that actually knew Michael coming to that screening. So I think the emotion in the room was sort of palpable. You sort of could really feel the quietness, which you didn't get in Toronto or New York. It was really like this rapt audience, and then there was big applause at the end, so which was really surprising.
Yeah, it was lovely.
I didn't expect it, so it was very, very emotional. A lot of people rushed off afterwards saying, "Can't talk, too emotional."
Yeah.
And sent me nice messages, but you could definitely feel it in the room and in the Q&A afterwards, that there was a good feeling there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The woman next to me was, I think she was sobbing. It was a bit awful
dear.
In the dark.
Right. It was interesting. We had a few different edits of the film, obviously, over the past year, and a few of them were sort of, you know, we're doing test screenings ourselves, and we're going, I'm not crying. I don't know. We gotta make them cry. You know, we're not crying. We're not feeling the emotion. And then we had our crying expert, Lynn Marie, who's one of our editors. Who co-directed Echo Homo. Uh-huh. She said, you know, give me a few months, I can make them cry. And then, it's just one of those things with editing. It is a very sad story, but yeah, it's a combination between, sadness and uplifting, you know, keeping the spirit up at the end, and not just making crushingly sad, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's almost, I mean, like the Bible, you got to have a resurrection, but after your crucifixion. But it was a very interesting process, and it was definitely an emotional homecoming, much more than it will be in Melbourne. Even it was like, you know, this is. You know, we had Rhett there and all of Rhett's friends and you know, so you could feel the that kind of connection in the room. So to me, it was a very different film. It's like I'd been quite uncomfortable watching it in New York and going, oh, I could tighten that, but that didn't happen last night. It was really like, oh, actually, it seems to be working.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Talking of editing, I heard that you spent 18 months. Actually doing the edit, which is a long time.
Yeah. Freaked the producers out, but anyway.
It was an interesting edit, I thought, because it's kind of, you know, it's very non-linear in one way.
Yes.
And I just wondered, the time you spent on it, was that just because it was hard to find a rhythm at first, or did you just struggle with having...
Yeah, it's definitely hard to find a rhythm, but it's more structuring the story. I mean, Michael's life was structured like a Greek tragedy.
Mm.
But, a lot of stories, a lot of dramas are based around sort of one big love story, or there's a girl that he's in love with. But, you know, he's like this serial monogamist, so he has a true love, then he has another true love, and then he's like... And that in itself makes a storytelling difficult, because you sort of go... You tend to go, oh, I like the Kylie bit, and I like that. It's sort of segmented, but we did... The biggest issue was the how to talk about childhood, and not just to start in childhood and say... Here he was as a child, and then he's growing up, and then he did this, and then, you know, it's sort of like we did have an assembly very early on that was just for the sake of chronology, sort of we had it like that, and we never intended that to be the film. And so then we'd start, you know, edit a different sort of, there's editing within the sections, and then we start playing it. In different order, so you'd go how do we link back to tell the Rhett story now, you know, mm-hmm. sort of like, and then how do we tell the Tina story of how, you know, when she was the surrogate mother, and the placing of those backstories, if you like, became very important. And every time we did it, we had to re-edit and then screen it in the theatre and going, is that working better
yeah,
or
right.
working worse? And then
is that enjoyable for you, or do you just like that process, or do you just want it done?
No, that's probably the make. You know, in a film like this where the shoot is actually just recording audio interviews, that is the pleasurable bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
Where you can actually discuss and show and sift through all the different comments, and you also you got to see everyone's comments in the context of who they are and where they come from. You know, so the British might have their comments, but they're still coming from this kind of, you know, he's a punsy, dirty digger rock star, you know. They're still coming from that, where we don't tell us about pop music, we know about pop music, sort of NME attitude. And then, so Australian comments come from the, you know, we could do with more of this and more of, you know, it's like,
yeah.
So you gotta balance it all up in context of who says what from where. And so, yeah, I do actually like that, you know, being the sort of... the umpire, I guess, of all those different thoughts and what the editors are doing in the, you know, we edit mm-hmm. in this big open plan area, so there's three or four of us, and Andrew, our cinematographer, he's sort of doing rostrum work and saying, try this in here and try that, you know, so
yeah,
it's all like a community of filmmakers all throwing in ideas, and I'm sort of the umpire saying that works and that doesn't work, and then, you know, and then people will sort of quietly come in while I'm at home sleeping and snip things out that I put in, and then I say, where's that bit? And then I agree that what they've done is best. And so it is this organic sort of very creatively to-ing and fro-ing,
creative-throwing
sort of thing that I kind of enjoy, because I'm sort of trained as an editor, really, and then took to filmmaking a little bit after.
So you're more of a journey person than a destination person.
Yes, absolutely. I know, we knew that he was going to die, but I didn't know how he was going to get there.
Yeah. Does the band like the film?
The band did like the film. They only saw it relatively recently,
mm-hmm.
just 2 weeks ago, just in three of them saw it in the private little viewing theatre, and they were obviously very nervous going
yeah.
in. You know, there was all these sort of, you know, there was all this sort of stuff. Michael was going to leave the band, and they didn't know whether I was going to sort of get into all that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Michael was a tumultuous person that always had complaints about everyone on one level. So, you know, there's times, like any family, there was squabbling and everything. I'm not sure
yeah.
that they kind of knew or trusted me whether how much I would dwell on that stuff, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Well, I did wonder about that section with where you talk about Disappear, or that section
yes,
that focuses on
yes.
that, and I thought that must have been a bit hard for Andrew to, because it made him seem really petty, like, what, just
yes.
one song that you haven't written, you
yes.
know?
Yes, no, well, I, you know, yeah, I think that, well, we did get a few complaints about that in, not from the band members, but from possibly management, saying that's not how it happened, but then I double and triple checked, and it seems to be how it happened, and
mm-hmm.
and also there's absolutely no reason why Chris Thomas with his track record would make that stuff up. And yeah, but I think that's, you know, I think they were expecting the possible, I mean, I don't think they knew what to expect, but they were fearing much worse than that. So
yeah,
I do
right.
think the band members that saw us had the maturity to understand that everybody has squabbles, and every family has
yeah.
squabbles, and
yep.
that's sort of just a squabble, and that, you know, at the end of the day, they were this band of brothers that would, you know, would still be playing now without question, you know,
yeah.
that there'd possibly be breakups, then get back togethers, and you
yeah.
know, like a lot of bands, but I, from what I know of Michael, I don't think he would have broken up. He would have actually he was definitely frustrated with his current direction of music. That's why he was doing a solo album. But he would have taken a big break, like a lot of bands do, a year or 2 years. And then, you know, someone would have said, hey, you want to play this festival? Or, you know, he would have said, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
And they all, we all know that they would be still playing today, you know?
Yeah.
It's there'd be squabbles along the way because, as Michael says in the film, you know, the 20, 30 years is a long time to be with
with anyone,
people, playing
absolutely
the same songs, you know?
A brand new day to find new dreams and watch to a dream on black boy. Dream on, white girl, then wake up to a brand new day. To find the dreams are washed away.
Don't take this as a criticism, but I often, when I see films, documentaries about musicians, because a lot of the audience are there because they've connected with the music, you know, that they love those albums or whatever. And so that's their kind of in. And I often wonder why filmmakers don't, at some point in the film, just include a whole song as a breathing section. So you get these little bits where you're like, oh, I love this song, but it never kind of, you know, it never has its full run. And is that because of music publishing and not being able to have... it is?
What those bastards charge.
Oh, my God, they're horror stories, yeah.
But no, we did have a per-song rate, which is, so there's no excuse for that. But basically, we did, you know, when the music came through at a certain stage of the production, I did go overboard. I put, you know, oh, I love this song, and let's have it to the end. And I had the Max Q song to the end. And then we got, you know, the film was getting a bit overly long. And then we got a lot of complaints from predominantly the British saying, you know, you've fallen in love with the music. And honestly, they were the ones haranguing me to get the INXS music, you know. And so once I got the INXS music, they complained there was too much in it. And so, so then we started trimming the songs back. And then, yeah, but on a more serious note, it really is about keeping the flow of the story going. And when you have a complete song, you're sort of stopping the story just to, you know. But in certain cases, even watching it last night in a audience of obvious, you know, people that knew the music and knew the story, I do think I should have kept that song going, you know. It's like... But then again, I see it in New York and you don't have that connection and you're sort of going, I got to keep the story going.
Yeah, right.
It's almost like there needs to be two different versions, one for the fans and one for people just wanting the story of it all, you know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of complaints when we had, you know, I put in entirety of certain songs, and you know, what isn't this a great performance? And then there was comments come back from the BBC and from my English producer saying it looks like a music video, you know.
Yeah, right.
but you know, Mystify is in it in its full length.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was a really sexy guy. Do you think he was aware of that?
Yeah, he's absolutely aware of that. But also, you know, not in an arrogant way, not in a sort of I can seduce anyone way, but he was just aware of it, that it was his language, his sensual, you know, he was aware, he was very aware of other people that were sexy, and that was a language that he would, he could communicate with and they could communicate with. It's something I think, like he had the sexiness that you see in a very sexy woman. But he's a man. It's sort of it's not. It's a non-threatening sex. It's not like here I am
too.
A womanizer. It's just this sort of sensual cat-like thing.
Exactly.
So he's not there going, I'm a handsome man, you know, like you expect some male models or whatever would do. It's like, and he sort of used it in a very humble way. He would just sort of not necessarily focus it on you. He would focus his eyes on you because he was really interested in who you were and everything. But he was sort of a bit like a cat in that he would appreciate other people with similar, especially females, with similar body language. So it wasn't just like, I'm sort of... It wasn't just like, I am what I am, but as soon as he saw someone or met someone who had a similar sensuality, and that was like, I think, the Michelle story. She had a very similar sensuality. They just clicked, you know, just like physically, mentally and everything. And but it wasn't... The interesting thing about his sexuality and sensuality was it wasn't the main agenda. He really did... want to sit, you know, it might be an attractive person he was speaking to, but he was really did want to, you know, talk about who they were and what they did and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a vacuum cleaner, you know, can you actually, you know, you're doing this, that's fascinating, I'd really like to see your work, I'd really like to see, you know, blah, blah. And it was sort of, and then the sensuality came later, you know, if person was still around at 4 a.m, you know. He was like, oh, well, I guess we better go to bed now, you know. I've got to let you know,
you're one of my kind. 2SER. You know, just the words that turn me on.